Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Well, we're feeling very thankful here at WMNF because of the success of the one-day fund drive yesterday. Our goal was to raise $45,000. We raised $55,000. What that means is even less on-air fundraising this fiscal year than we had planned. We had planned to do a seven-day drive this summer. It looks like it's just going to be maybe a four-day drive this summer with two already completed. We're still taking donations online at WMNF.org. More people donated overnight, and thank you if you donated yesterday or any time this year. Thank you for making WMNF a success. Well, America is undergoing what is being described as the Omni-crisis. It's simultaneously confronting what seems like an unceasing barrage of challenges that threaten not only its position on the world stage, but also its very domestic stability. Those include a very tense domestic political situation overseen by possibly the most controversial president in recent history, a global pandemic, massive protests against police brutality. Yet, even before the coronavirus arrived in the Black Lives Matter protests, America was suffering. Its economy, long the envy of the world, has simply stopped working for a large group of people that live here in the U.S. Real wages have either remained flat or fallen for everyone except the top 10%, leaving 43% of Americans working for $15 an hour or less. Median middle-class family is just about $4,000 in liquid assets, and they would have trouble scraping up $400 in case of an emergency. All the while, living costs, including rent, education, health care, they've all skyrocketed. In fact, over 10% of Americans have no health care, with many more remaining underinsured. America's once mighty middle class has gone from being first in the world to 32nd per capita among OECD countries. Against this background comes a new book from a Yale-educated historian. The book is Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America from 1929 to 1968. The book was written by historian David Stebbin. He's a professor at Ohio State University, where he teaches political, legal, and constitutional history. And I spoke with him earlier today about his book. David Stebbin, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
How would you first, let's start here, how would you describe middle class?
Right, and it's a great question because people use it in different ways. They sometimes do surveys and almost every American thinks he or she is middle class. To me, it's people who cannot fairly be described as either rich or poor, right? And so in the era that I study, from the 30s to the 60s, an ever higher fraction of the population became middle class in the sense that you couldn't really call them rich, you couldn't really call them poor. The middle three-fifths, the middle 60% of the income distribution by the 1950s fit that description. And, there are others. Very upper middle class people tend to think of themselves as middle class, but by world standards, they're really affluent people. So it's more like the middle class or the lower middle class. And in that group were a lot of people who worked in factories, not just offices. So people who made cars and steel and so on in that era, because they tended to be unionized jobs, had good wages and benefits and so on. It was enough to support a family, buy a house. You had to live modestly by today's standards, but you could save money, build up a nest egg and so on. And by the way, it's partly an economic state, but it's also a state of mind. Right. In other words, if you think of yourselves as middle class, you're cautious with your money, typically, and you're focused on sort of security for the long term. So there are some people who have higher incomes who live like middle class people in terms of what they buy to eat and so on. But in general, it's that sort of middle 60%.
Did we have much of a middle class before the Great Depression or before Franklin Roosevelt was elected?
Well, even in the most prosperous years of the mid to late 1920s, close to half of all American households were poor or almost poor. In other words, even though the overall economy boomed in the mid to late 20s, the distribution of income and wealth was pretty unequal. And there was a rural version of this, Appalachian whites, people in the South, white and black, who had low incomes. There was a big city version of this. So the people living in crowded tenement buildings and so on. So what interested me about the topic, because of course the middle class has shrunk in recent decades and people are concerned about that, was, well, let's look at the last time the middle class got a lot bigger to see how that was accomplished and with what results. So in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, things changed. The Great Depression democratized, if you want to put it that way, economic insecurity. All of a sudden, a whole lot of households were worried that they might suffer drastic economic decline. And so voter attitudes changed. All of a sudden, there was much more support for policies that regulated banks to make them more reliable, that created some kind of a safety net, especially for people who lost their jobs. Unemployment insurance came along then, that sort of thing. And then, of course, the war came along. In other words, the Great Depression was an international phenomenon, and it tended to produce more conflict, not less. And eventually that conflict came to America's shores with Pearl Harbor. And there are different ways that the country could have waged World War II. Because Franklin Roosevelt was still in the White House, it waged World War II, the government did, in a New Deal-ish kind of way. So the wages paid to the soldiers in the armed forces were very high by world standards. The wages paid to people working in the factories to build the things needed for the war, they were also high. And taxes on the affluent to pay for all of this were high. And so coming out of the war, all of a sudden middle-income people had money in the bank and had higher incomes, and the tax structure tended to work in a way that promoted greater income and wealth equality. And so when retailers and business people reconfigured the economy after World War II, they did it primarily with middle-class people in mind. So the houses that were built were modest-sized houses, 900 to 1,000 square feet in the suburbs, and modest-priced cars and so on. And there were more expensive things to buy, but most of what was available to be purchased fit the budgets of middle-class people. And television contributed because, of course, it's such a powerful advertising vehicle. And when TV emerged in the 50s, the overwhelming picture of American life on TV was middle-class white families. And that tended to reinforce the sense of what was normal in terms of what to buy and how to live. And so for people who are in that world, they tended to like that era a lot. The system was set up for them.
Well, we're talking with David Stebbin. He's the author of the brand new book, Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America, 1929 to 1968. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Just getting back to the mechanism of how the middle class grew in that era, was it unions? Was it the minimum wage? Was it a 40-hour work week? Was it unemployment insurance? What was the mechanism, the chief mechanisms that propelled the growth of the middle class?
Well, one is this sort of greater, stronger welfare state or social insurance system or safety net. Economists use all these terms. So it became, if you did fall out of the job, the labor force for a while, it didn't necessarily translate into disaster. So that's one thing. Another for men was compulsory military service. In other words, World War II brought the draft, and then the Cold War came along thereafter. So the draft was around almost nonstop from 1940 through the early 70s. And the draft is a mixed blessing, so to speak. Not everyone wants to serve in the armed forces, but there were young males for whom military service, it made them more productive. Right. It also often improved their health because of the diet and the medical care that they got while they were in the armed forces and then later as veterans. And crucially, the GI Bill. In other words, they could afford to go to school after military service, and they could borrow money at very low rates to buy a home or to start a business. And so it was primarily a male breadwinner model. Right. But it sort of strengthened the ability of men of modest backgrounds to rise economically. And of course, they were supposed to follow certain rules. They were supposed to get married and stay married, and be competent, effective husbands and fathers and so on. So there were more social restrictions on what they were supposed to do as they became more prosperous. And so there are a lot of different things, and they tended to be mutually reinforcing, right? And if you're wondering why people would opt for that, both the Great Depression and World War II, and to some extent the Cold War, made people much more interested in stability and security. Americans like freedom and individuality, and they like stability and security. What changes over time is their relative preferences, how much they emphasize one or the other. And the generation that grew up in the 30s and the 40s had an unusually strong preference for stability and security. And so they tended to opt into marriage early and family life to save their money and so on. And their children, the baby boomers, sometimes were quite rebellious, right? In other words, they had grown up with all this stability and security, and they tended to take it for granted. And they wanted more individuality. And so by the end of the 1960s, there was a kind of youth rebellion against the priorities of their parents. But for the parental generation, the quiet suburban life was the thing they could not have growing up. And then after World War II, it became possible, not just for affluent people, but for a huge swath of the population.
You talked about the social welfare state. I mean, you're talking about government. Oftentimes when there's a debate about how America came to be great, if we could call it great, we hear people say, well, it's companies and it's free enterprise and it's corporations that make America great and it's the capitalist system. But what you're saying is that it was government programs, including the universal draft, that helped to create this broad middle class that we enjoyed from the early 30s to the late 60s.
Right. And there's just as American attitudes towards individuality versus security and so on, that spectrum, another is sort of the amount of government intervention. And when the crisis of the Great Depression came along, it changed attitudes. All of a sudden, there was a big demand for competent, effective government intervention, because government didn't make the Great Depression. In other words, the private sector was dominant at that time, and the view in the mid to late 20s was exactly what you described, the sense that free enterprise and the market system and entrepreneurialism, they're what make America great. And no one expected the Great Depression. It did not, the Communist Party expected the Great Depression, but nobody else did, and they were tiny. And so all of a sudden there's this crisis that demanded government intervention. And by the way, the first effort under President Herbert Hoover was ineffective, incompetent intervention generally. It didn't work. And he made a lot of people mad at him. And so voters tossed him out of office. And by the way, in fairness to President Hoover, he was a very intelligent and accomplished person. But he had spent most of his life in the private sector. He was a former businessman. He had never run for public office before until he ran for president in 1928. And he did not respond well to what voters wanted. In other words, when attitudes changed and voters wanted the government to do more to end the Depression, he resisted that. And so voters tossed him out, and they elected Franklin Roosevelt, who was a career politician. And they have their pluses and minuses, but career politicians tend to be very good at figuring out what voters want and trying to give it to them. Mm. They're professional political people. And that's what happened under FDR. And so it is an era of bigger government, right, in some ways. By the way, the business community didn't become irrelevant. They are a partner in the post-war prosperity, and they reconfigured the way they did things. So it's an era, if the people want more stability and security, the big employers of the country tended to hire people, train them and retrain them and keep them for 30 years. In other words, that was the nature of the contract, you want to put it that way, between workers and employers. And there's some very good things about that from the point of view of employers. In other words, if you invest a lot in training your workers, what you want is that they will be loyal and stay long term, and then you get that investment in training back. And so there were very many employers across the land in that era that's what they did. And Nowadays, for a lot of employers, they might like to do that still, but it's frustrating because talented workers tend to move around from place to place. They're less willing to stay in one place long term. Mm. But one of the things that changed worker attitudes on that crucial point was the Depression. In other words, when unemployment moved into the double digits and stayed there for over a decade, workers became much more interested in staying at the same place. In other words, the feeling was the work, the boss knows me, I do a good job, I'm less likely to be laid off. And so it changed the nature of the employment relationship. And by the way, one of the closest parallels to then and now is the sudden return of double-digit unemployment. In other words, where we've been for the past 3 months is a place we haven't been since 1940 and 41, the last 2 years of the Great Depression. And no one, by the way, no one knew in the early 30s how long the economic downturn would last. When the stock market crashed in the fall of 29, many people thought, well, this is just a blip. It'll go away. And it didn't, because the crash exposed other underlying weaknesses in the economy. And they came forward and the Great Depression developed. No one knows now for sure what's going to happen. In other words, it could be that this is a relatively brief, and one always hopes that, economic downturn, or the unemployment that has returned at such a high level may stick around for a while. The longer unemployment remains high, the more the attitudes of Americans change about these sorts of questions of stability and security and so on. So the book is sort of timely. I didn't write it expecting this situation to happen just as it came out, but I think it will increase reader interest. Americans, their way of thinking changes. And these are not partisan statements. If you look at the government, in the 1930s, it began spending a lot more money to deal with the problems created by unemployment and so on. And all of a sudden, the federal government is once again spending a lot more money, creating a bigger deficit and so on. And both the Republicans and the Democrats have participated in that. In other words, necessity tends to drive the policy. And all of a sudden, the necessity is different.
Our guest is David Stebbin. He's a professor of history and law at Ohio State University and a specialist in modern American political and legal history. His book is Promised Land, and this is WMNF in Tampa. When I read about Franklin Roosevelt, he came into office not wanting to be an activist. That wasn't his intention. And as he made these programs, he was called a traitor to his class. You mentioned the small Communist Party. There was also a lot of labor movement activity, the sit-down strikes in Detroit. Was Roosevelt pushed into this, or was he headed there all along to create these programs that would expand the middle class?
Well, he was always skeptical about the celebration of big business in the 1920s. In other words, Franklin Roosevelt's role model, and he had one, was Theodore Roosevelt, his Republican cousin. And Theodore Roosevelt had come of age politically at a time of great wealth and income inequality. And there was a kind of Great Depression in the 1890s, and that very much affected Theodore Roosevelt. So his approach was government needs to play more of a role to sort of reduce risk, stabilize the system, and make it work better for ordinary people. And Franklin Roosevelt came from that philosophically. And so in the 20s, his way of thinking was sort of out of step with the mood of the time. And then times changed. And it's one of the interesting things about the Great Depression, like today, is how abruptly, suddenly, things can change. And so when the stock market crashed and things all of a sudden got very bad, the Franklin Roosevelt's perspective, the government needs to do more than just stand by the sidelines, suddenly became much more relevant. And he was not a socialist. And you're right, he had an upper income background. His idea was, if you're a rich person, you owe certain things to the country and the people who don't have your advantages, right? And you owe them the chance to do well. America's supposed to work well for to create prosperity and opportunity for the many, not just for the few. And so there was a split in the upper class during the 1930s and 40s. And he definitely had upper-class support. He definitely had some business support. But he also made a lot of upper-class people angry. They really didn't like the higher taxes, right? And taxes rose in the 30s, and then they rose a whole lot more during the war. And never did upper-income people pay more in tax than during World War II. And they really, that was painful for a lot of them. One way of describing that era is not just that the middle class rose, but the upper class, to a degree, declined. The gap between the way the affluent lived and the middle narrowed. And that was painful for those who were on the sort of the downward escalator. But the point is, the good news about that was that upper America, and many of the leaders of our country are in that group, acquired a better understanding of middle America, because the distance between the two narrowed. And so there were some very nice things about that. Employers and employees could relate to each other better. Americans in general had more in common in that era that I study, especially in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. They tended to shop more at the same kinds of department stores and eat more of the same kind of food. And so the class gap, if you want to put it that way, between the top and the middle, shrank. The opposite of what we've seen in recent decades.
You point out in your book, though, that two groups really essentially are left out or not included in the way that white males were included in the rise of the middle class from 29 to 68, and that is women and people of color, especially African Americans. Why were they left out of this tremendous growth of the economy?
Well, when the Great Depression hit, we'll start with women, a much smaller fraction of all women were employed in the paid labor force then. In other words, the model, there's a farming model where, of course, it's sort of a family operation, but in terms of the wage and salary economy found in cities and towns, that world was much more male-dominated. And so the focus of the New Deal and government in general was to get men working again. And then the military service aspect of the military service was mostly male. And the GI Bill of Rights after World War II created a lot of benefits for men, including a preference in employment. And so it was a very much a male breadwinner model. And there are many women who were okay with that as long as their husband made enough money to support them all comfortably. But not every woman is like that. And so some women were quite frustrated by an era where they were essentially obliged to get married and stay married. And even if they were not well suited for marriage, or even if they wanted to pursue more career-oriented or employment outside the home-oriented options, right? And so it's a kind of mixed picture for women. And the fraction of all women who liked the so-called traditional arrangement where he goes off to work and they stay home, the fraction of women who liked that was higher in that era, in part because the Great Depression and World War II so disrupted family life. In other words, there was a deficit in the number of people who could get married and have kids in the Depression. And then, of course, during the war, so many of the eligible men were away. So there was a pent-up demand, if you want to put it that way, for home life and stable family life. Their children is another matter. And it was the next generation. The baby boomers had different thinking about that. In terms of the African Americans, they aren't completely excluded, but they participated much less equally. And one of the most important ways is they're shut out of mass suburbia for the 25 years after World War II. So there is mass suburbia all of a sudden. Huge numbers of Americans move to the suburbs to live in modest-sized middle-class houses. But African Americans can't go there. And so they miss the opportunity to become suburban homeowners. By the way, there's also a regional dimension. You're in Florida, and in the era that I work on, the South was predominantly rural and much poorer than the rest of the country. So Southerners experienced the rise of the middle class much less in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. These things are related because African Americans were disproportionately a Southern people. When the Great Depression came along, 80% of African Americans still lived in the South. And so They suffered by virtue of their race, but they also suffered by virtue of being disproportionately Southerners. And by the way, one of the other reasons I wrote the book was to provide readers with some sense of what a new and improved version of a more middle-class country would look like. And it would include African-Americans in terms of more. It would allow more flexibility on gender roles and gender relations. You know, if you sit down and think about it, it's not too hard to imagine a new and improved version. There are more men who cook, and that's a good thing. There are more women who can change tires. You know, gender roles are not so strictly divided as they used to be. So, and I would think that a lot of Americans would be interested in a new and improved version. There would be no way to recreate exactly the old version, and I don't think most people would want to do that. But the new and improved version, well, that's something else again. It would tend to reduce social tension, conflict, social problems of all kinds if the middle class got bigger and more prosperous again. But only if you do it in the right way.
You know, I always wondered, though, why when President Obama was elected and he had, I think, 8 or 9% unemployment rates during the Great Recession that he inherited from President Bush, why he didn't become the next Roosevelt. And now you've got even higher unemployment. So whoever's elected in November has the potential to institute a new wave of middle-class expansion through government programs. But I don't hear either President Trump nor Joe Biden talking about this in terms of Franklin Roosevelt, in terms of what Roosevelt did to expand, take more people into the middle class of the economy.
Right. I think Joe Biden is oriented toward expanding the middle class. In other words, when he was in the Senate for many years, representing Delaware, his nickname, given to him by his fellow senators, and the Senate tends to be an affluent group, he was Middle Class Joe. In other words, he was from a middle class background, and he reflected the values of that group. He was also just about the poorest U.S. senator. He was an ordinary middle class guy. He owned a house. That was his main asset. That's very middle class. And so he relates well at a personal level to folks like that. He grew up around them. A white middle-class family. The issue for today, for the campaign, is the situation we're in economically as a result of a pandemic, is it temporary? And by the way, in the 1929-1930, the same issue arose. In other words, President Hoover at first thought this would be temporary, and so no need to make major changes. And so he didn't do much at first. And then things got worse. And then the things he did were not terribly effective. And so people got very frustrated with him. And then when that happened, he dug in, became sort of unresponsive. There was a big protest by unemployed veterans of World War One in Washington in the summer of 1932.
The bonus marches. Yeah, the bonus marches.
And he sent in the army to get rid of them. And that, by the way, politically was the last straw. In other words, no one could call these people un-American. They were veterans, and they had come because they were unemployed, and they wanted the government to pay them a bonus that they were supposed to get later, sooner. And their idea was, A, we need the money, B, we've served the country, and C, it would be good for the economy because we're going to go out and buy things, and retailers and so on in our towns will like that a lot. And Congress said no, President Hoover said no, and then he sent the army to disperse them. And that was just a public relations disaster, and his campaign never really recovered. And voters threw him out of office. Not so much because they liked Franklin Roosevelt, who was an untested quantity for most people, but because he wasn't Hoover, right? In other words, it was a throw out the incumbent kind of election. And so today it's very unclear how long-term this situation is, both in terms of the pandemic and the related economic consequences. And no one wants a long-term economic problem, high unemployment. No one wants to solve America's problems that way. But the point is, the longer this goes on, the more voters will demand a bigger and competent, effective government response to the pandemic and the economic problems it's creating. So it's a little unclear yet to what degree there's an exact parallel between now and then. But there's something of a parallel. And there was a view for a long time that Depression-era unemployment was the great exception in American history, and we would never see it again. And Depression-era unemployment is just double-digit unemployment. And now it's returned. And there, if you listen to the chairman of the Federal Reserve, he said it's not clear when it will go away, right? And that's changing attitudes, voter attitudes, and so on, very much.
Well, David Stebbin, author of Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America, 1929 to 1968, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
Thanks for having me on.
That's David Stebbin, who teaches at Ohio State University. He teaches law and history, and he's written a new book called Promised Land, How the Rise of the Middle Class Transformed America, 1929 to 1968. We did that interview earlier today. And if you want to comment about the interview, you can call us up at 813-239-9663, our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Just looking at the history.com website about the GI Bill, here's a little bit more about the GI Bill. While the GI Bill's language did not specifically exclude African-American veterans from its benefits, it was structured in a way that ultimately shut doors for the 1.2 million black veterans coming home from World War II who had bravely served their country. When lawmakers began drafting the GI Bill in 1944, some Southern Democrats feared that returning black veterans would use public sympathy for veterans to advocate against Jim Crow laws. To make sure the GI Bill largely benefited white people, the Southern Democrats drew on tactics that they had previously used to ensure that the New Deal helped as few black people as possible. That's from history.com. And, of course, the New Deal coalition headed by President Franklin Roosevelt, he needed Southern white Democratic members of the House and Senate in order to get his legislation passed. So he deferred to them, often on race issues, oftentimes at odds with his wife, Eleanor, who was a civil rights advocate, but President Franklin Roosevelt, not such a big civil rights advocate. And here's a little bit more on the topic of the GI Bill. This is Chuck Collins, who was just on this program a few weeks ago, talking about how billionaires and other very wealthy people were making money in the stock market while the economy was collapsing. He wrote a book a few years ago about income inequality. He's with the Institute for Policy Studies. And here's Chuck Collins answering a question about the GI Bill. Let's listen to what he said.
You bring up in your book the GI Bill.
Yeah.
Veterans come back from World War II. They're given a head start by the government with certain advantages, go back to school, buy a home, loans, et cetera, et cetera. But it wasn't for all veterans. And so what is the domino effect today that we're seeing from this program?
Well, I think the GI Bill also first-time homebuyer loan programs after World War II. So between 1945 and, say, the mid-70s, we, the taxpayers, invested in things that put millions of families, almost all of them white, on the wealth-building express train. I have friends and family members who got Veterans Administration or Farmers Home Loans, 1% 40-year fixed-rate loans. Those were racially discriminatory. Black, Latino, First Nations veterans returning to the United States after World War II to sometimes Jim Crow education systems did not have access to some of those GI Bill college benefits. So it's kind of like we put one segment of society on the express train to middle class opportunity, and we left people of color standing at the station for the train that didn't show up. And so a couple generations go by, you know, lo and behold, our home ownership rate, the white home ownership rate is about 70%, and black home ownership rate is like 43%. That, we can point back to that period after World War II as one of the reasons for that.
It goes that far back, wow.
But what's interesting about that is that gave us a clue as we sort of know something about what to do. Like, we used to tax wealth at higher levels and higher incomes, and we invested in public goods, access to education, first-time homebuyers, infrastructure. Those are all things that are part of a shared prosperity economy that we could do without the discrimination and legacy of racism in implementing those.
Well, that was Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies talking about his book, Born on Third Class. So the question came from Magalie Laguerre-Wilkinson from the Carnegie Council. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to open up the phone lines and take some phone calls. We already have a bunch of emails that I haven't read yet. And thanks again if you donated during the one-day fund drive yesterday. Our goal was $45,000. We raised $55,000 in one day. That means that even less on-air fundraising will be required this fiscal year, less than we had planned. So thank you for making the contribution at WMNF.org. Well, Bill Grace is our phone producer today. Let's go to Dave in Tampa, who wants to say something. Hi, Dave. What's on your mind today?
Hey, good morning, Rob. I listened to the David Stebbins interview. That was good. I haven't read his book. But one thing I didn't even mention that stands out to me is he didn't once mention antitrust enforcement as being critical to the rise of the middle class.
Well, it's a 400-page book. We didn't mention a lot. So I hope you'll excuse it.
It seems to me that antitrust legislation and enforcement during that period of time was central to the rise of the middle class, and it parallels today because you have these massive economic powerhouses like Google and Facebook and Amazon, which are clearly monopolies. They're exercising monopoly power over our economy, and there's attendant political power with that. And you don't get a middle class when you have that kind of economic firepower involved in your economy. And this type of thing goes all the way back to the East India Company when we had a revolution over that. The Boston Tea Party was about that. The corporate economic power needs to be atomized or at least divided in a way where nobody has that kind of, like the power of Mark Zuckerberg didn't exist. The Roosevelt starting with Teddy and Woodrow Wilson right through FDR and Truman, that wasn't around.
All right, did we lose you?
Yeah. Right. No, I'm still there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you dropped off for a little bit. You know, I mean, it's impossible to cover a book that covers the breadth of history, the economic history of 1929 to 1968. It's impossible to do it in 20 minutes. And he does talk about business regulation in the book. And I don't think he would disagree with you. I think he would say that regulating monopolies is important. And as you have more and more monopoly power, you put more and more small businesses out of business. So
exactly.
I don't think
right.
he would disagree
That's
with you at
parallel.
All.
Parallel. I mean, in this country right now, I think we ought to be talking about it much more because there's such a, I mean, it's so strongly parallel to the period when Teddy Roosevelt came along.
You know, Dave, I think there's a whole host of issues regarding the shrinking middle class and business regulation being one of them. But I think that there are a whole host of issues. You know, the statistic that I read at the top of the show, and I hope you heard it, 43% of Americans are working for $15 an hour or less. And what can you buy for $15 an hour? You can't own a home, or you can't own a nice home. You might own a very small home or a mobile home. Can you send your kids to college? Can you pay for daycare? Can you pay for quality food? Can you pay for transportation? The low wages in the country, that's where I would start. I mean, I think monopolies are a big problem. I think people are underpaid in this country, and that's a huge problem. And, there is an issue on the ballot this year, but it wouldn't raise the minimum wage to $15 for another 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you're right, Rob. I mean, I think also labor rights goes hand in hand with that. I mean, we live in a right-to-work state, and, that's all part of it, too, when you have these giant economic powerhouses that can drive down wages.
Plus, if you get sick in this country and you carry home that debt from the hospital and you're paying bills for months from companies or providers that you don't know where they came from, you've got a huge deductible. Don't get sick in this country. You're going to lose your grip on the middle class.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, compliments, man. I really, it's nice to hear some economic conversation on the air. But I think we ought to be thinking about it more. We need to, and I think
All right. Well, I hope you listen to Richard Wolff. Richard Wolff is on every other Tuesday.
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks, Dave. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. If you want to agree or disagree with something you've heard, you can email us. Jack writes, we should change Donald Trump's title of Law and Order to Law and Disorder. This is Jack writing from Palm Harbor. He says, from his pardoning of convicted criminals to his changing of all the environment laws to suit industry at the expense of the public, it should be enough to convince anyone with any sense who is voting the coming election. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, writes Jack in Palm Harbor. Stephen writes this, was the middle class ever an idea or a goal, or was it some sort of fluke of capitalism? Where too much money went around to everyone? It began in the 1950s, it ended in the 1990s, writes Stephen. We are a capitalistic society, writes Stephen, which is the rich and the poor. It is a thing of the past that we can never recapture simply because of globalism, writes Stephen. All right, Stephen, I hope I read that right for you. David writes this, one thing among Trump supporters is a very selfish attitude on American life. They seem to have no interest in public welfare, but are only worried about themselves. And now the Trump tax cut in the stock market has helped them. Is this because Trump is clearly not a public servant, but only a self-servant, writes David. David, thank you for that. Suzanne writes, what was the reasoning behind the African-Americans not getting the GI Bill? I think it goes back, Suzanne, to the Democratic coalition that Franklin Roosevelt held up. And there were some great strides for everybody, Social Security, unemployment insurance, an easier ability to unionize, but there were laws that were designed to keep out African Americans too, and that was what Roosevelt had to do to keep his coalition together. And we are free now to criticize that if you want. Again, our phone number 813-239-9663. Let's go to Karen in St. Pete. Hi, Karen. You're on M&F. Thanks for calling in.
No, it's Sharon.
Oh, Sharon. I'm sorry.
No worries. My dad was involved in some way, I don't exactly know how, in the Korean War. And when he got home, he got all these benefits. And we had this, and there's a place called Levittown, Pennsylvania, where it's in Bucks County. And they all have these nice little houses, and everybody got happy, you know? And so I think that was a good way to help them, but I didn't realize that black people and other people weren't given the same opportunity.
Well, you know, I've not been to Levittown, Karen. Sharon. I'm just guessing you're white. Did you live in Levittown?
I did.
Yeah, were there any black people in Levittown?
No.
Yeah, I mean there were deed restrictions, and I think Levittown is one of those communities where they were not allowed to sell houses to African Americans. I'm going to have to look that up. I know Fresh Air has done a program about that.
I love that every time I listen to your program, I learn something that I didn't know. And I thought that it was really good that my dad got the GI Bill and had four kids, and you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I'll bet life was good in Levittown too. I bet. right.
Except for
the segregation, right?
So, but it's different now, and I want to be aware all the time. I refuse to close my eyes to what might have happened and how my dad got benefits that someone else's father didn't get.
Well, I think it's good that your dad got the benefits. Now the question is, how can we extend the same kind of benefits to all people in our society? And Sharon, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Here's Jeff writing in via email. Jeff writes, I think Bernie Sanders had policy ideas that might revive the middle class. It seems our corporate media, along with the Democratic Party, refused to let him succeed. Trump seems to clearly be failing. If it's Biden, will there be real changes? With this pandemic, we're not looking good. I hope it turns around. Yeah, do you think that either President Trump or Joe Biden have addressed the issue of expanding the middle class? What do you think? 813-239-9663. Joe Biden was on this radio program in 2016, and I asked him, was he paying attention to working class issues? And he assured me from his office up there in Washington, D.C., that he was, that the Democrats were paying attention to working class issues. We'll see what he does now that he's running for president. Maybe we'll get him back on the show with any luck. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. And let's go to Al, who's in Odessa. Hi, Al. You're on M&F. Thanks for calling in. Hi, Al. Can you hear me? Al in Odessa? All right. Al.
Is this me?
Well, are you Al?
No, I'm not. They didn't take my name. I'm Doug.
You're Doug. Okay. Doug, I'm sorry. Doug, what would you like to say?
All right. Now you got me
confused.
Off my track of what I was going to say. I think what I was going to start out with was there was a saying, and I can't remember it exactly, but you'll get the point. It is, for everybody to get a bigger piece of the pie, it doesn't mean that other people have to get less. You just make a bigger pie, and it seems like. There's probably a lot of things going on where the pie is getting smaller. I'll say the environment for one. What's going on with the environment? I know there are a lot of big issues out there, and I'm way off track already.
I confused it by calling you Al.
Yes, I think you did.
All right, sorry.
The real point is that. You just build a bigger economy to allow everybody to participate in it. And there are clearly ways to do it, however you want to characterize them. Other two quick little points I'll make, because I listened to the topic of opening up the schools, and it seems like it comes down to the same two points that always come up, the economy versus quality of life or so forth. So, I don't know. I guess we'll let it play out.
All right, Doug. Yeah. I'm sorry I had you so confused. It's the wrong way to start, and I'm sorry I picked up and called you Al, but that's what it said on my screen. So I'm sorry about that. And Tony writes this great interview with the historian who wrote Promised Land today. One difference between today and the post-World War II era is that the U.S. now has far more economic competition from many other foreign countries, and our terrible response to the pandemic is making us even less competitive in today's world, writes Tony in St. Pete. Kay writes this, maybe someone beat me to it, to the Post, but shouldn't we be very alarmed about the virus data going to the White House instead of the CDC? I simply cannot see how this can be a good thing when the Trump administration is always trying to beat down testing. Yeah, that's an important story. We've had it on the air here via NPR. The White House apparently wants hospitals to report their COVID-19 testing data and local health departments to report their data to the White House and not to the CDC. It would seem that it should go right to the CDC. I don't know how the White House is capable of handling that data. And there are other instances, and we've talked about that a bit here on WMNF, and that is that there's a whole question about whether or not the data that Florida is publishing every day, and which is on TV every day, on local TV channels, whether or not that's accurate. There was a state worker fired, Rebecca Jones. We've talked about her a lot on WMNF, and she says she was fired because the state wanted her to fudge the data and make it appear that the COVID-19 cases are not as widespread and serious as they really are. And so she was fired by the state, so she's put up her own website, which she says has more accurate numbers about COVID-19. Let's go back to the phones, and maybe this is Al in Odessa. Al, is that you?
Yes.
Okay, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Just basically on the economic thing, give a personal point of view. My parents came over in 62 from Portugal, and I know that the economy was good then because basically World War II had trickled down through the economy. But it seemed like there were a lot more people in decent shape, being that the money was flowing throughout instead of just percolating down from the top. And, I mean, my parents, one had a fourth-grade education, one had zero education, but yet they raised 9 kids, and they all had college, and they all owned homes, and they passed away owning 2 homes. So something is going awry. In my point of view, it started from Reagan on. Reaganomics basically blew the whole thing apart and made a mess of everything.
Yeah, I think a lot of people agree with that. Al, when your parents came over, what city did they move to when they came from Portugal?
Bridgeport, Connecticut.
And what did they end up doing, their first jobs? Do you remember what they did?
It was basically laboring. My mom worked in a scissor factory, bottom of the barrel. But then my father got into the union. And, of course, the union made middle class.
And did he get a defined benefit pension when he retired from his job?
Yes.
Yeah.
What helped was he was probably in his late 70s when he retired. And my brothers all had construction businesses, so he fell into that gambit, being a coffee boy.
but at least factory wages back then, or union wages back then,
you could create
a middle class.
It was poverty wages. You'd have guys riding in on bicycles for their jobs and living in, day rental. It's a total screwing over, let's be honest, what was the middle class.
Yeah. All right. Al, thanks a lot. That's a good story. Thank you. And let's go to Charles in St. Pete. Hi, Charles. You're on M&F. What would you like to say?
Good afternoon. I'm an old guy. I benefited from the Korean version of the GI Bill. I grew up in Chicago in the 30s and the 40s on the South Side. And I spent most of my life as an electrician union. I wanted to make clear that racism in our society is so embedded that when I was doing college in the 50s, the electricians had 6 black people in the union in Chicago of about 3,000 membership. The first public housing.
So the unions discriminated largely because Chicago had a lot of people that had moved up from the South who were African American, and the union discriminated against letting them join the union?
The trade unions, even into this day, have a serious racism problem. The CIO made a difference. The AFL was...
Yeah, I used to work with coal miners, and I was struck by how many coal miners who were in the United Mine Workers Union were African American. And I always assumed that if you're in the hills of West Virginia or the mountains there in Kentucky... that if you're a miner, you were going to be white. And I met so many African Americans. So there were some unions that were progressive.
Yeah, but you're a generation or two younger than me, and that was different then.
Yeah, well, these are guys who probably went work in the mines in the 50s. So, Charlie, I don't know how old you are, but.
One other thing I wanted to say on that same subject, as bad as it is. Illinois legislature, when they finally got around to approving public housing, they would only allow one door in any apartment, and that was the bathroom door.
That's terrible.
Yeah, that's the kind of trivial.
Yeah, that's just punitive. All right, Charles, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. Thank you, Charles. And Robert wants to disagree. He says there's a common misconception that all of the beneficiaries of these tax cuts are just sitting on piles of money. Certainly, there is a problem with too much wealth held among a few individuals, but what about those at lower level below them who also benefit? Robert goes on to write, what about contributions to various charities like public broadcasting, St. Jude's Hospital, and WMNF. So, Robert, thank you for your email. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks for listening to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Stay tuned for the Midpoint program right here on WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. NOLA will be along on the Midpoint.